Business and Labor for May 6, 2013. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 142. Jan, could you summarize, please?
Madam Chair, committee members, this measure permits an authorized agent of an incorporator, director, officer, receiver, trustee, or fiduciary of a business entity to execute filings with the Secretary of State. Allows limited use of the terms cooperative and partnership in business names or titles. Provides exceptions to the Secretary of State's duty to return acknowledgement for documents filed with the Secretary of State. Allows a business entity to undertake activities appropriate to winding up and liquidating the entity and its affairs. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact. There's no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. And I think speaking on this bill is
Mr. Frickle from the Secretary of State's office.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Peter Threlkeld, Director of the Corporation Division of the Secretary of State's Office, and pleased to speak with you about Senate Bill 142. We really look at this as a bit of a house-cleaning bill. All of the issues were suggested to us by our business customers. We'd like to take a look at the laws that we administer and see where there are places that create friction for the business community and how we can streamline them, make them work a little bit better. And this is the result of our current effort there. So one of the first pieces we want to do allow an authorized agent of a business to be able to make filings, the annual report filings on behalf of the business. Currently, right now, the law says you have to be an officer, you have to be a director. So we've got law firms where they're handling this type of work for their clientele, and to legally comply with the law, they have to go to some fairly extraordinary lengths where they say, okay, you're going to appoint us as the officer for filing annual reports with the Secretary of State. No other duties. It's sort of a silly workaround. We think that businesses have had to deal with a lot more complexity in the world where they outsource this to somebody that's a specialist that takes care of that, that makes sure that their business documents and their annual reports get filed and they stay active with the state. This is a good service for them, but we'd like to streamline that process. Just says that if the business has authorized their attorney, service company, another provider to file on behalf of them, that should be okay. So we think that's a good step in the right direction. We also ran into some situations where cooperatives, there was a foreign cooperative that was based out of Idaho. They merged with an Oregon cooperative just across the border. There's a discrepancy between our business statute and our cooperative statute that says if you're a foreign cooperative, you can't use the word cooperative in your name. So, I don't think it was intentional, just sort of trying to reconcile the two statutes. We provide a fix for that. We're also one of the only states or few states in the country that doesn't allow a limited liability company to use the word partnership in their name, so hasn't really been so much of a problem in Oregon. We just say, no, you can't do that. But when LLCs from other states want to come into Oregon and bring jobs or set up shop, we unfortunately have to say, well, this is what Oregon's law says, so if you'd like to go back to your home state, change your name, you can come and we'll welcome you into Oregon. We think that as most LLCs really operate as a partnership, this is just a quick little fix there as well. We think that we'll be a little bit more uniform with the rest of the country and good for those businesses that if that's how they want to set up their business name. The acknowledgement requirement, this is just the sending an acknowledgement on the annual report for a limited liability company. All of our other business statutes are set up so that there's no acknowledgement required there. we think that that was just an oversight when the LLC law was set up. We want to just make sure that our office is able to be as efficient and effective as possible. Standardizing the services across the platform really helps us to do that. So that's just a little cleanup there. One of the things that we are, that's actually tied in with that we are implementing here in the next several months is an email acknowledgement system so that whenever there's a change or a posting to a business registration, we would send out an email. So that would actually be a better service, more timely for people, and would actually offer that and across the spectrum. The final thing that we have is allowing administratively dissolved businesses to have the same ability to wind up and liquidate their affairs as a business that does a voluntary dissolution. So this really gets down to the legal terms between the definitions of what's appropriate and what's necessary. And so we have one group of people that, in order to sometimes follow the advice of their attorneys, they have to reinstate their dissolved corporation so that they can dissolve it. And it sort of gets into, you know, how you dispose of property, how you liquidate the assets of the company, just some of the limitations that the law has. We think that we should be as uniform as possible there. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. We'll open up the questions that we have, Mr. McCauley. You want to come on up? And in fact, get ready. And if you have any questions,
Would you like me to
wait? I'm
happy to.
Why don't we just wait? Okay. We'll wait and we'll get you all at one time.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCauley. I'm here representing the Agriculture Cooperative Council of Oregon in support of Senate Bill 142. And first, I want to extend appreciation to you, Madam Chair, and committee staff for facilitating the introduction of House Bill 2846, which was to address the cooperative name issue that you just heard about. And we're here specifically to support Section 5 of the bill, which takes care of the issue that arose when the members of NISA Cooperative Supply in Malheur County voted to merge with another cooperative that just happened to be across the border in Idaho. The name of the merged cooperative was to be Valleywide Cooperative. And it turns out that even though Valleywide Cooperative has members in Oregon, has two locations in Oregon, in NISA and Durkee, sales, everything going on in Oregon, they could not use the name of their own company in the state. Senate Bill 142 corrects that problem, and we urge its passage.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you. I have a question regarding the first section of the bill. First of all, it's a dull and boring bill.
And now, let's go easy.
You know, it's I appreciate you bringing it forward. So the first section involving allowing authorized agents, presumably attorneys 95% plus of the time, to execute those, it seems that in the post-Enron world, we, being, I guess, policymakers around the country, have kind of made a conscious choice to go in the other direction, to actually require senior executives to personally sign those things for a reason. Presumably, I would suppose, for later criminal sanctions. I think there were some evidentiary issues in terms of proving Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling's mens rea. And when they actually sign these things, if there's fraud involved, the hook's really deeply in them. Can you talk about that?
Chair Doherty, Representative Barton. There's, I would say, a significant difference between the annual report filing that you make to the SEC as a publicly traded company and the annual report filing that you're making to the Secretary of State. The level of information that we're collecting is really who are the primary officers, where is the business located, who's their registered agent for service of process, and that's about the extent of the information.
But not the stuff of major fraud, huh?
It is not the stuff of major fraud.
Okay. Representative Holby.
Thank you. And to follow up with that, you probably know what my question is already. But I'm curious about seeing how we're enabling attorneys to be the agents for businesses to register in Oregon and to make these filings. Is along those same lines, do we have where are we at with requiring them to actually have a place of business in Oregon? In other words, can I have a foreign company from Belize, for example, and have a an attorney file my papers in Oregon and operate in Oregon without actually having any place of business, and also who are the beneficial owners of the company, individuals, not other corporations or other LLCs being the beneficial owners. Do we have the ability to track track the beneficial ownership of companies?
Chair Doherty, Representative Hovey, a couple of questions there. So as a foreign corporation, you can come in. You don't actually have to have a physical place of business in Oregon. You do have to have an Oregon registered agent, so with a physical address here in Oregon, so somebody that could accept legal service for that business. The Oregon statutes actually don't have a very solid definition of doing business in Oregon. Mail order companies, internet companies that aren't located here, don't have employees here, really aren't required to register. So that's sort of an outside issue there. As far as the beneficial ownership information, as we've discussed, this is something that Congress has been looking at. There's not currently a bill in the current Congress, but there's whispers that it might be reintroduced. We feel strongly that in order for Oregon not to be an outlier or a state that's not viewed favorably by businesses that want to register, or that we create higher burdens than our neighbors, we think that the beneficial ownership question is going to be addressed, it needs to be a uniform national solution. So that would be the relying on the action of Congress to say all the states shall operate in this manner, and so we're kind of waiting for that information or that action now.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, thank you. Any other questions to the panel? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
You want to move this bill this morning?
I think so.
Sure. Close the public hearing. Oh, I'd like to close public hearing on Senate Bill 142 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 142.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 142 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 142 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, hearing none. Brandon, could you take the roll, please?
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Whitener.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Excused.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kenner.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Do we have a carrier on this one?
I'm happy to, if you wish. Sure.
Pardon? Okay, Representative Barton.
Vice Chair, if you want.
Okay.
Doesn't matter which
way. Just
want
to go outside and fight it out?
No.
Okay.
You can have it.
Okay, thank you. So I close the work session on Senate Bill 142. And I open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 205. Jan, if you could summarize.
Madam Chair, committee members, this measure eliminates the requirement that rules adopted by the CCB, the Construction Contractors Board, specify certain contract terms that must be included in all contracts. There are no amendments, there's no revenue impact, there's no fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Good morning, welcome. Madam Chair, members of the committee. Craig Smith is my name. This is a fairly simple bill. It's a minor policy change. This has to do with Construction Contractors Board requirements for residential contractors. And today, a residential contractor needs to put their contract in writing. If the contract is over $2,000, this bill would not change that. However, when we originally did this requirement back in 2007, we put some of the requirements into statute. And since that time, we've come back several times because those statutes, they weren't working out. And we have added some by rule. What this bill would do is it would require that the contractors board set the rules for what should be in a written contract. And that we would be able to change it then with administrative rules. It will take out a couple of things that are currently not working out so well that are in statute. I think you have my handout in front of you. You may have it electronically. If you look at page 3 in that handout, you would see our current administrative rule that has to do with the residential contract requirements. And there are two items there that are grayed out. If this bill passes, by rule, we'll take those out because we'll be allowed to. We can't do it now because they're in statute. The first one says that the statement to contractors is licensed by the Construction Contractors Board. We think that's redundant. Contractors already put their license number on the contract. That would remain. But to have a separate statement that the contractor is licensed doesn't seem to provide much of a service. And to be honest with you, a lot of contractors don't do that. That sets them up for possible fines. We don't want to do that. We think this one can go away. The second is a list of the notices that are given to protect consumers. You get a lot of notices whenever you do a mortgage. You're probably familiar with that. Those of you who are contractors and perhaps do some residential work know about these notices. They are important. We wouldn't want to dilute those, and they need to be given. And they need to be given today at the same time a written contract is required, anytime a written contract is required. So they go along with the contract. However, to list separately in the contract what those notices are, frankly, we don't think that's important, and we'd rather see the time spent on the notices themselves. So both of those items would go away if you approve this bill. This comes to you from the Senate, where it was unanimous, 28-0. Can I answer any questions?
Actually, I have a question, Craig. So with the elimination of D, you still give people copies of, you know, the different requirements, and they have to go through and say, you know, it is you within 3 days you can, you know, blah, 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 all of that. So those copies of things are still given to people. It's just in the contract that a buyer signs, they don't have to list the contract of all of the different requirements.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that's right. The notices would still need to be given, and in fact, contractors need to maintain proof that they gave those notices. It would just not be listed in the contract.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, I see none. That's the only person signed up. Does anybody else want to speak on Senate Bill 205? Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 205 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 205.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 205 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 205 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I'll just discuss. I don't think a conflict of interest is in order, but just out there.
Yes.
I'm saying that I do have a company that registers with the CCB.
Okay.
We don't do residential, maybe a tiny bit.
Okay. Thank you for letting us know. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Seeing none, Brandon, could you please call the roll?
Representative Whiteman.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative
Holby. Aye.
Representative
Fagan.
Excused.
Vice Chair Representative
Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative
Kennemer.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty. Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Somebody carry this to the floor. Okay, Kennemer. So I close the work session on Senate Bill 205, and I open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 207A. Jan, if you could summarize.
Madam Chair, this measure requires limited partnership applicants for construction contractor licenses to include, as part of the application, the name and address of certain members of the limited partnership. Requires the reporting of any changes in names and addresses of certain limited partnership members, and it deletes redundant reporting requirements. Establishes residential locksmith services contract license and establishes a home inspector services contractor license. You have before you a proposed -A4 amendment that establishes a home services contractor license and a proposed A5 amendment that modifies the definition of a non-exempt class of independent contractors for CCB licensing.
Okay. Craig, you want to start out?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. This bill, 207A, comes to you by a vote of the Senate 30-0. It does two things. First thing it does is help us with identification of parties on a limited partnership. Identifying the human beings that are part of the business that we regulate are hugely important to us in the our efforts to try to hold contractors accountable. Very few contractors do terrible things, but very, very few do. And when that happens, sometimes they come from other states. Sometimes, sadly, it's domestic. But when it occurs, we need to know who those human beings are. In this packet of information that I understand you have in front of you, you'll see a chart on page 5. And the original problem that we were trying to fix are second and third tier owners of a limited partnership. Limited partnerships, remember, are the general partners and then the silent partners. We don't care about the limited partner in a limited partnership, but we need to know who the general partners are, even on down the road, because in the worst case scenario, sometimes the bad actors will try to hide who they are, and they'll do that by having various businesses associated with the primary business. We need to know who the general partner is in the second and third tier of the limited partnership organization, and that's what this bill would allow us to do. We amended them. Can I answer any questions on that?
Sounds like he's going to go on.
We had an amendment to the bill on the Senate side, and what it does is it adds new license categories, business license categories, for home inspectors and locksmiths. And the reason that this was important to a few of our stakeholders as well as the agency was that it came up in Ways and Means. And the thought was that with these businesses, particularly in this economy, why should they take the same kind of test and the same kinds of continuing education requirement, bond and insurance requirement, that, for example, a home builder might take? It didn't seem to make sense. It seems like we could set up a limited license, if you will, for those special interests. We're talking about home inspectors and locksmiths at much lower cost. This will save those starting businesses as much as $500 for their first year. We think it makes sense. That we think the protections are still there. And so this bill also sets up those special licenses for those two groups. Okay.
So that's just this, the dash four is just for those two, just for home inspectors and locksmiths?
Madam Chair, actually, that's part of the A, that's the A engrossed version. So they're part of the bill that passed the Senate.
Okay.
I do have an amendment, though, if I can talk to you about that, if you're ready to go with that.
Any questions? Ready? Okay, go ahead.
I passed out a letter that we received from Representative Olson's office, Abby Weekly, name is on top. And that particular letter came last fall, but we didn't get it until most recently. And it talks about a contractor who, in the Albany area, is engaged in commercial business activity and is trying to survive, like a lot of our contractors are, and has a problem with regulation, of course, besides trying to find a way to sell the goods and services that they do in this tough market. One of the things that occurred back in 2007 was we divided contractors into residential and commercial groups. We found a way to try to keep the costs down, but it still causes some consternation. Part of that bill that came to you from the industry to separate commercial contractors had a special requirement that is you've been noticed of, you've had some notice about over the course of the last 5 years, and that's the part that requires exempt commercial contractors to obtain workers' comp insurance for themselves, for the owners. It's called personal election coverage. It's been somewhat controversial. I think there are good people on both sides of that issue. This amendment does not address that specifically, okay? So it doesn't change that policy. What it does change, however, is it affects people who lease workers. Leasing workers is a fairly common practice in the construction world today. It's becoming more I think, common than it was back in 2007 or 20 years ago, certainly. We think it makes sense. Leasing workers is different than temporary workers. Leased operations are licensed through DCBS. And when you lease workers, the workers' comp is paid by the leasing company. Yet the way this bill was structured back in 2007 with the definition of employment or employee, if you have 20 people that are your regular employees one day, you'd be licensed as non-exempt. And think of it as non-exempt from workers' comp requirements. That's important because when you're on the work site, people can see on our website and other locations that you're non-exempt. It means that you have employees. It means that you have workers' comp and the regulations that that fall from that protect Oregon workers. But when you lease workers, because of the way the law is written, you have to be licensed as exempt. We'd like to change that. We don't think that makes any sense. They should be in the same bucket, if you will, the same independent contractor class as those who have regular employees. That's what this bill would do. And we think it solves two problems, or that's what this amendment would do. First of all, we think that makes sense that they be classified as non-exempt because they have workers' comp on their people. They get them through the leasing company. The other thing it does, though, and this is this speaks directly to Mr. Hines's problem, is it gets them out from underneath that personal action coverage that we don't think it was meant for businesses like this in the first place. So this amendment that we speak to you today about, dash A5 amendment, we urge you to give due consideration, and I'm here to support it. We'd like to get your support for that as well. Can I answer any questions about this?
Representative Holby.
Well, let's start with the last one first. If I may, I have two questions. The non-exempt, we're moving a contractor to a non-exempt status if they use a leasing company?
To the chair and Representative Holy, that's correct.
And has the workers' comp division weighed in on this? Just
they have not yet.
Okay. And my second question, if I may, mm-hmm. Madam Chair, it goes back to the original bill. And I think I talked to you briefly about this, but I wanted to refresh my memory about the home inspector license, where the bill appears to eliminate the possibility of the CCB requiring any testing or educational requirements for home inspectors, which seems like home inspectors, you know, inspect and give their opinion a lot of times in the effort to make sure the home is, you know, sound so that we can get a loan on it. And so it sort of protects the buyer and the lender. So is there some, standard that replaces these educational requirements that will protect the buyers and lenders that are requiring home inspectors?
Madam Chair and Representative Holvey, thank you for the question. That's a good question because I don't want to leave that confusion out there. In fact, this when you think about home inspectors and locksmiths, both of those disciplines require the individual that practices those trades to take a test administered by the Construction Contractors Board. And there is also continuing education required for the home inspector. Those individual licenses are not affected by this bill. Those people would still have to be tested, but they're not tested on business issues like the home builders are and like the remodelers are. And so the answer to the question is this does not affect the ability of the Construction Contractors Board to test those two practitioners, if you will, the human beings that do the work. This just takes away the business test and the business continuing education for those two disciplines.
Thank you.
Okay, other questions? Okay, let's go back to the dash fives on here. So what it is, if I am like the gentleman that wrote Representative Olson, So if I have a company, but all of my workers come from a leasing agent, a leasing company. That leasing company is the one that carries the workers' comp, and currently I am considered an exempt or non-exempt person.
To the chair and to the committee, yes, the way the law is currently written, because you don't actually have employees when you lease your folks, the way Oregon law is set up, the actual employer is a leasing company. And so the way the law is set up, you have no bona fide employees or regular employees. Therefore, the way the definition of exempt and non-exempt is set up, you have to be in the exempt category. That's the reason why it adds confusion. It doesn't make sense.
So this bill does what?
What this bill does is it takes, if you have leased workers, it puts you in that non-exempt category, and it solves those two problems.
And so if I'm in a non-exempt category, that means what?
Well, not it's just a category. It's a great question. It's just a category. Normally, non-exempt means you have employees.
Okay.
And the way the law is set up, it's set up so that if you have more than two owners in your organization, as long as they're not family members, you have to be in the non-exempt category. And the reason for that is you need workers' comp coverage once you get over two people in your business operation. Or if you have employees, you have to have workers' comp. And so what this does is it treats people who leased workers the same way as if you had the workers yourself, from the standpoint of what class of independent contractor you're in. Again, the benefit is you know, out in the work site, it reduces confusion. And from the standpoint of a commercial contractor, it keeps you from having to pay personal action coverage on the business owner.
Okay, so does the owner need workers' comp? And what I'm looking at is the email that this gentleman wrote. And so would this gentleman be considered, would have to go out and get additional workers' comp, or?
Okay, and to the chair, members of the committee, this person would not have to have personal action coverage. Only his workers would.
Okay. Other questions? Oh, we're not moving this because there's a fiscal on it, so.
Just one. Thanks, Craig, for this, because I understand a little bit about the confusion. But if a construction contractor leases his employees, are they allowed to have employees of their own as well? And so I think that's where the original exempt status came from, because I don't believe they're allowed to have leased employees and their own employees at the same time. But this confusion is more about the owners of the company.
Madam Chair and to Representative Holby, it sounds like a couple of different questions there. Let me see if I can dissect them. I think the problem results from the words exempt and non-exempt. I don't know if you can have a leased employee workforce and then some regular employees on the side. I can find that out and I'll get that information to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Well, sort of, because I know in a temp agency world, you can have both your own employees and employees from the temp agency. But I believe in a leasing agency world, you can't have your own employees. You only have leased employees, which is, I think, why they originally said those companies are exempt.
I suppose that's possible. I don't believe it even came up during the discussions back in 2007, but I could be mistaken on that.
Okay. We do have two more people. Representative Thatcher, you got a question?
Oh, just weighing in, but reclassifying them as non-exempt would mean that as soon as they do get employees, they're automatically having to purchase workers' comp insurance on them.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Right.
That's good clarification. Gentlemen?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the National Home Service Contract Association. And these are companies who provide home service warranties in the state. They've been in the state of Oregon for decades. They've not been licensed by the CCB ever since they've been doing business. They're companies, normally you'll find these products in homes sold through realtors, for instance, where You buy a new home, you may have your appliances covered, you may have your HVAC system covered under a warranty for a specific time period. And again, there's these products vary from low deductible, high deductible, 1 year, 5 years. It's just it's a product that's offered normally on a sale of a home. Home service warranties, again, they've not been licensed. There's been issues within the last year of whether they should be licensed or not. And I know I've been working with Greg Chamoff, with Davis Wright Tremaine on this particular issue, with the industry and the CCB on looking at, you know, how, again, there's a gray area whether they should be licensed. It falls because the gray area is caused because of the definition of contractor. And that definition talks about arranging for work. And again, this is a company out there that if your HVAC system, let's say, breaks down, you call the company just like you would maybe an insurance company. They send a licensed Oregon contractor out to fix it, and it's taken care of. The question is, do they arrange for the work? That's where the issue has arisen, and what we decided to do instead of fight the issue, and again, working with the CCB, is create a limited license for these particular companies. Similar to what you heard earlier with locksmiths, the home inspectors, and something created a while back, several sessions ago, dealing with developer licenses. So what the bill, the Dash A4 amendment, that's really what we're here today, it's just focusing on the A4 amendment. If you look on lines 6 through 8 of the amendment, it defines the home service contractor license, and if you look on line 8, they do the repair of the service through a licensed contractor. So that's how the business is conducted today. They're using licensed contractors. So these are folks who are under CCB now. They're licensed. They do all the continuing edge. They take the test. What we feel is for the company, we don't need to go through all of those steps like a licensed contractor. And so there's two ways. You know, either we're exempt from CCB law, which right now we haven't ever been licensed, or we actually become a contractor, which, you know, again, insurance companies aren't contractors either. And so we're trying to find that middle ground. That's what the A4 amendment does. If you look on page 2 of the bill, it does the two things that I think are the consumer protection part of the bill on the limited license. It provides the bond, $10,000, and general liability insurance of $100,000 requirement. So that is the link between the consumer and the remedy of the CCB. And so it's similar to a registration system. I know it's been called in most other states, but under the CCB, again, they refer to them as limited licenses. And so this resolves this issue in this gray area for the industry. Again, we've been working with Craig on it, happy to answer any questions, or if any questions on for Greg Chamoff, who's actually been working on the issue, we're happy to answer those, and would ask the committee to support the A4s. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Barton?
Thank you. I usually try to direct my questions to Mr. Chamoff, just because he's like the smartest guy I know. However, actually, I have a question for you, sir. I gather you've been working with them on the bill. And looking at the A4, there's subsection 3 and 4. In section 5A, the first page there, subsections 3 and 4, it says the CCB may not impose continued education requirement for the home services contractor and also may not impose any kind of test. That makes sense to me, given this context. It makes a lot of sense to me why you wouldn't want to begin with, because it might not be necessary. However, things change. I'm wondering how you feel about codifying that in statute. I understand why they would want that, but I was just wondering if you have strong feelings.
To the chair and to Representative Barton, first, we're neutral on the amendment.
Okay.
And we think that we can certainly administer the law if it becomes law. And so I don't think I'd offer an opinion at this point on that. We'd want to see how it works out. And we think that it mimics the other two A portions of this particular bill for home inspectors and locksmiths. They do have their own training involved. This one would not. But the interesting thing about this is that it would this is more akin to the exemption that the Assembly gave developers. And that's worked out pretty well. Remember how developers work. They don't take the test. They don't have the continuing education. Yet they do quite a bit of work in Oregon. They do it pretty doggone well.
Okay.
So we would expect that this would be the same.
Represent that. And we're going to have to speed up a little bit. I thought we'd have lots of time today, but we still have three more things to go through. So Representative Thatcher, then.
Well, I guess, Sean, had questions about really what was the problem you're trying to solve. It's a gray area, but so what? And wouldn't a broker, I mean, wouldn't they kind of fall under the definition of a broker in a way, too? They're arranging for somebody else to do work. They're just kind of getting a, you know, it's a commission from somebody or something, you know, to get payment for arranging that work. I mean, they're not doing it, so.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, it's a gray area because we think it's white and they think it's black.
If you could identify it yourself.
I'm sorry, also. Madam Chair. Greg Chamoff from the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine in Portland, representing the association along with Mr. Miller. Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, we have a dispute over whether the term arranging applies to folks halfway across the country who are looking in a phone book and picking someone who is a licensed contractor to do work in Oregon, whether that person needs a contractor's license or not. Conceptually, a broker would seem to be in essentially the same situation where as long as they are making a good decision about hiring a contractor, one could argue that that person need not be as fully licensed as a contractor is these days, but that's not the issue that this amendment is trying to solve.
Quick follow-up. I just want to know who they are that you're disputing. Who is the dispute with?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, Mr. Smith and his colleagues.
Are they?
It was the CCB.
Oh, the CCB.
Yeah,
thank you. Okay, that clarifies it.
And the CCB.
Got it.
So again, what we're trying to do is avoid a fight.
I
here.
See the gloves sitting
and,
there.
Yeah, the A4 actually solves the issue to where we don't have to fight over whether we should be completely exempt, which the industry is now, or on the flip side, if we lose, they would be full contractors, and they're really not full contractors. Mm-hmm. They're using licensed contractors to do the work, so we're trying to find that middle ground. That's what the A4 does.
Okay, thank you.
And I'll try to be quick, Madam Chair. I understand this bill. I, you know, think that it's good that you're coming in for a limited license. And the reason that you're not like a broker is because brokers in Oregon statute are exempted from the CCB license. Your types of organizations are not. And so if you're arranging for work and having a contract with an owner in Oregon, you are acting as a general contractor, I believe, under the current law. I guess I'm a little bit concerned on two aspects, that there would be no measurement of knowledge about the practices and laws affecting construction contractors because you're actually being a general contractor and arranging for that work, which you're not exempt from the laws there. So I'm a little concerned about that, and then I have a question for Mr. Smith. If in fact one of these organizations was found in violation of not using licensed contractors, would you have the ability to revoke their license under this?
And to the Chair, Representative Holy, did I hear the question right? Are you asking if this bill became law and if there was a company that was licensed and had this limited license and if they used non-licensed personnel, would we have authority to revoke the license?
Correct.
On
that instance.
The answer would be yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Representative Holy, I think the one difference, because I think your initial thought was that they're the same as a general contractor, and I think a general contractor is quite a bit different than these companies, and I'd view them more as the developer license because they're really not, you know, the knowledge of the construction industry of the work, they're using a licensed contractor who has all that knowledge. And so, again, they're the ones that are being sent out to do the work, dealing with the customer. They're also on the hook in this particular issue. And so it's more in line with that developer license versus deeming these companies like a general contract. I think that's the difference that we see.
I would just argue that you're actually conducting a contract with the owners of the property and also hiring subcontractors or other contractors as well. So you have a contract with that, so you're operating as a general contractor, essentially.
So pretty much the issues here is having home inspectors and locksmiths license, having a limited license.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the task force. Okay, any other questions?
Just one comment. General contractors generally do a portion of the work themselves. I mean, that's kind of the whole thing. They don't just purely subcontract all the work out to somebody.
Not always. Some do sub everything out.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, we can't move this bill because we still have to get some fiscals on it, but we can move, and I know that there are some questions out on the dash fives, but we can move the dash fours amendment, which has a licensure. So, since I've opened a work session on this, dash fours.
No problem. Dash fours?
Go ahead.
Well, why don't we just hold it? We'll just close the work session. And if you guys can answer the questions of the folks up here, I would appreciate it. We'll reschedule this. Okay, so I close the work session on Senate Bill 207. And we're going to be dealing with 268, 269, and then go to 264. So I open up a work session on Senate Bill 268. Jan, if you could remind us of what that is.
Madam Chair, committee members, the committee heard this measure 2 weeks ago. It allows supplemental retirement benefit amount that's contributed for employees of the State Board of Higher Education, or OHSU, to be transferred to the PERS fund to offset liabilities for the employer contributions if the employee separates from service before the required period for vesting. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no amendment before you. There's no revenue impact. The fiscal statement has been issued.
We've opened the work session, right?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Representative Barton moves House Bill, or Senate Bill 268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll?
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Bowlby.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Excused.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Do you have a carrier on this?
I'm happy to.
Okay. Representative Barton.
Interesting.
With that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 268 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 269. Jan, again, if you could summarize.
I will. Madam Chair, committee members, this bill specifies requirements for participation in an optional retirement plan by administrative and academic employees of OUS. Creates a separate tier for employees contributing to the optional retirement plan hired on or after July 1st, 2014. Specifies contribution levels made by the State Board of Higher Ed for participating employees hired after that time, provides for limited employer match to the employee contribution, deletes language defining parameters of selection of the investment and annuity providers, and states the provisions do not affect collective bargaining agreements, declares an emergency effective on passage, no amendment, no revenue impact, and a minimal fiscal impact was found.
Okay, Representative Barton.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 269 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 269 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Excused.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Somebody like to carry this? Okay, Representative Thatcher. Okay, with that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 269, and I open up a work session on Senate Bill 264.
Madam Chair, committee members, the committee heard this measure 2 weeks ago. It includes qualified employees of OUS in the definition of managerial employee for collective bargaining purposes. And you have before you a dash one amendment that specifies that faculty members who teach courses for credit are not managerial employees. There, on the original bill, there's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Do we have people signed up for this one?
Maureen Wright.
Okay, we had Maureen Wright. Bridget, are you going to talk on this, speak on this one? Okay. And we have about 8 minutes, so. And if you could identify yourself for the record before your testimony, please.
My name is Maureen Wright. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I'm appearing today as a private citizen and in service to the public good. I happen to be a faculty member at one of the institutions of higher education in the fine state of Oregon. So, I like to thank you for your patience. This is the first time I've done this, and so although I'm familiar with students staring at me, this is a little bit out of my comfort zone. I tried to anticipate what would be of interest to you, and so if I missed the mark in the interest of your time, please do ask me questions because I wanted to be thorough.
Well, because I think the one question I have, maybe you've gotten your testimony, is currently are there people like department chairs and provosts and all those sorts of people that teach classes? And I think that's just the question that I would have.
In our understanding of the contract, faculty members are not considered managers at my particular institution, and my particular institution does not have the job category of provost. Mm-hmm. There are managerial employees who have other positions, including line managers and second, third, and fourth tier managers who are teaching credit courses.
Okay. So would this mean that they could not teach credit courses?
Yes, ma'am. And I believe that based on my reading of the statute, that's consistent with the statute. The purpose of the definitions is to create segregation and separation of duties. Managers do managerial work, and faculty members do faculty work, and that specifically is teaching credit courses. Mm-hmm. So it's been our experience that there's been a misunderstanding by some managers that the clear structure of the segregation of duties has been violated. And in private conversations, some people are under the impression, because of perhaps the colleges they went to, the private colleges I went to, it was very common for managers and deans and provosts to lecture and to mm-hmm. provide credit courses. However, under the statute that applies ORS 243, it's frankly illegal by a plain reading of the statute. And these five small words would actually give us a basis to have an informal conversation in the spirit of harmony and good faith to clarify to those managers who, for whatever reason, have basically violated the statute. And if you'd be interested in, and I can give examples of how egregious the violation of the statute has become. And I love my job. I love public service. I've dedicated my life to it. But I'm very concerned that if we don't address this matter, there's likely to be a media scandal when it's discovered that some managers are earning the equivalent of two full-time salaries, one as a manager and one as a full-time faculty member. And we're all sensitive as public servants to the appearance of a violation of the public trust. We have the additional issue that some managers have actually signed their own payment authorizations to approve their pay when they teach credit courses.
So in other words, I mean, I have a degree from Portland State in speech, and our department chair, we were a small department, maybe six faculty members. So the department chair taught classes. Would this prohibit the department chair from teaching classes?
No, my understanding, in our contract, they specifically define the faculty department chairs as faculty members, and it's very consistent with what happens in public safety organizations where sergeants and captains are considered part of the bargaining unit because of the commingling of their duties.
What would happen if in other universities that do consider them managerial, would this prohibit them from teaching classes?
I'm sorry, I'm not prepared to make a general statement about other places. I can talk about the specifics from my research and from what happens at my college. But my understanding from what I've read, and I've read fairly extensively, is that it's, however they're defined, is basically accepted as if they're what they call a community of interest. And that's sort of worked out between the labor organization and the managers. So it seems to be unique to the organization, that based on my reading.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some questions, and I'm sorry, I gather there's some background. I feel like you and the chair kind of delved into a policy discussion, and somehow what this is about was never became entirely clear to me. But I gather that is currently you're saying illegal under current law for a manager to also teach courses for credit. Is that right?
My understanding of a plain reading of the statute is it says managers are not faculty.
So, a follow-up, if I may. When he was, and this is just an example that occurs to me, when he was president of the University of Oregon, Dave Frohnmayer, I think, was also a concurrent professor at the law school, if I'm not mistaken, and would periodically, not often, but probably once a year, teach kind of a small class, either at the law school or to undergraduates. Are you saying that that was a violation of the law?
Well, pardon me, but I don't believe that David Frohnmayer is currently employed.
Yeah, and when he was president of the university.
I don't particularly know during that time period if the language was the same. I only more recently looked at it.
I see.
But my understanding, to be strict about it, would be it would be improper if he were a manager in that particular organization for him to teach credit courses. And the general position of our faculty members is that if someone wants to teach, and certainly someone with a wealth of knowledge, let them teach in an institution where they're not a manager.
That's a quick follow-up.
A quick follow-up, because I want Bridget to be able to go. And I think we understand what the issue is.
If that
and
is current law.
And we've got your written testimony. So.
Yes, thank you, ma'am.
If that is current law, what is the purpose of the amendment? Because it seems like the amendment then would just reaffirm what is current law.
Well, twofold. One is that the purpose of legislation is to provide guidance to policymakers. So if we operate under the assumption that there's a misunderstanding because of isolated incidences that happened in the past, this actually opens up the conversation, and it avoids any embarrassment for people who unwittingly trespass when they thought, based on, you know, random examples of someone distinguishes David Frohnmayer teaching or someone beloved, as in my institution, teaching, that although we're fond of that, it's actually not appropriate. And that often happens, that things that are quite endearing to us are really not proper. The other thing that it does is, in the event that this matter is litigated, which is entirely possible, you will have provided, as policymakers, guidance to the court or the body, which will determine what your intent was. And I believe that based on the whole nature of collective bargaining, the nature of collective bargaining is to segregate duties. So it seems to me like it's a very simple housekeeping amendment, and it actually promotes harmony because, at least in my institution, it's kind of a friendly way to say, please reconsider. There's other issues, but please reconsider, because now the legislature has provided you with clear and definitive guidance and clear boundaries.
Okay. Bridget, could you testify?
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System. I'm happy to briefly offer some comments on the -1 amendment. As this is our legislation to fix an issue that came up as a result of 242 and was mainly about solving the divided loyalty issue that I believe she's alluding to, we actually don't find this to be a friendly amendment, and we're not interested in it for a few reasons, and I want to briefly highlight those. First, I want to flag that this legislation is primarily focused focused on OUS. What it does is it makes it so that our employees who are no longer considered state employees, they're actually now considered employees of the public university system. It pulls them back under statute that deals with this divided loyalty issue, where if you're a manager, you're also not a member of the union, or at least you go before the ERB board to determine whether or not you should be. Second, this legislation only pertains to collective bargaining, and that's important because as we seem to be talking about some other issues that are not necessarily just about collective bargaining. So one thing I would flag for you is that folks who are managing employees at OUS do frequently teach, and we think it's actually a best practice for a variety of reasons. First, deans and department heads have a great level of expertise on a variety of subjects, and we think it's important for them to stay connected to the classroom because we think that's how you create good public policy for the classroom experience, is if you stay connected. And remember that a lot of these folks started out in their careers because they're passionate about the classroom experience and teaching. And I think that Representative Barton, your point about President Frommeyer is accurate. Furthermore, Chancellor Emeritus Pernsteiner has taught for years at Portland State and done so without pay, as has Vice Chancellor Jay Kenton. He teaches public finance courses, and I don't think there's anyone else who could probably teach higher ed public finance courses better than someone who's done it for 30 years in a variety of institutions, and he does it without pay. So these things happen. It's a variety of practices that happen depending on the level you are at the institution. Department heads are actually required to teach, and they are also managing employees. So I think I could bring my legal counsel in to give a stronger interpretation, but we actually don't interpret it as was previously mentioned. Finally, I would say, as we're consistently asked to increase efficiencies, this is a way we keep our costs down, is that we capitalize on the expertise throughout our institutions, and we benefit in the classroom level by allowing them to teach while at the same time managing employees. Finally, this amendment would actually create a greater conflict for us, because what it would do is make deans and department heads now potentially members of the union, and therefore you have only an increased amount of the divided loyalty that we were trying to solve. So for these reasons, and I'm happy to provide more information, and I also believe that Rob Wagner at PCC has expertise specific to this issue, I'm happy to talk further, but I know you have limited time, so
Our time ran out about 4 minutes ago. Questions of, I think, because we can bring, unless Ms. Wright comes back, do you have questions of Ms. Wright specifically or with this? No, we'll give another five, and then we are already late for caucus. Representative Witt.
Thank you very much. My question is, does in the collective bargaining agreements that exist within OUS, is it universally true that bargaining unit work is defined?
Chair Dougherty, Representative Witt, I believe so. What happens is with this managerial employee piece, I have limited expertise in this area, so I would flag that. ERB, the Employee Review Board, they determine what is a union employee and what is bargaining employee, who is in the bargaining unit and who is not. They look at the job description. They look at what your functions are. So I believe that it is actually defined. I don't know much about that, however.
Follow up?
Please.
And does that include managerial employees?
Representative Dougherty, Chair Witt, Representative Witt, I believe that there are some managing employees who potentially could be a part of the unit. It depends. At some institutions, members who are deans and department heads, it really would depend on the specific circumstances. So I don't think that painting with a broad brush will give us a clear understanding. I'm happy to follow up with more detail on this matter.
Madam Chair. That's specifically the reason we have the amendment before us, I suggest.
Representative Wyden.
Thank you. Question I'm concerned, you can get the numbers for me or give them to everybody if anybody else is interested. But the other thing I'd be curious on, how many professors have retired drawing PERS and then they're coming back and teaching classes as consultants?
Chair Dougherty, Representative Widener, I'm happy to look into that matter and get you some information.
Okay, thank you much. Representative Bart.
Thank you. Just a brief comment. There seems to be a clear difference about what the current law is. Yeah. I think that's where the disagreements stem from. I will tell you that in terms of what Ms. Burns said about best practices, et cetera, her comments about why we want certain administrators teaching occasionally makes a lot of sense to me. Having said that, Ms. Wright's statement of the current law, I not knowing case law, but at ORS 243.650, subsection 16, the last sentence does say, manager employee does not include faculty members at a community college, college, or university. The definition then becomes, what is a faculty member? And anyway, her reading the statute is not unreasonable to me. And so to the extent you have counsel who can provide clarity about maybe there's case law about what this means, I would love that. Perhaps we need to clarify.
Thank you. Any other questions? You look like you have a question.
Well, I just wanted to point out, if I recall, a gentleman from the OUS wrote us back and said that this particular bill would not apply to the universities that are potentially, if the university board bill goes through, that those universities wouldn't be subject to this same law. It seems like we'd want to have some consistency, but I thought you'd point that out, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions of Ms. Wright? Because I'm going to close the hearing pretty soon, and we're going to continue because we do have some questions on this. But any of you have any specific questions of Ms. Wright? Okay. Thank you very much for bringing
this. Thank you
very much. With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill. Which one is this? 264. And we will continue. If you guys have questions, please give us the answers, and we'll go from there. Thanks much for your patience, you guys. With that, I close the Committee on Business and Labor.
I have questions.